Welcome to hour two of today's reading of the Arizona Republic for Monday, July 27th. I'm volunteer reader Philip Varellan. Reading remotely, we read from arizonacentral.com. We read the electronic edition of the Arizona Republic, known as the e-newspaper. And on Mondays, we always start with Sunday's death notices. Judith Allen Gish Weiss, 77, Phoenix, Arizona. Roman Berezinski, 86, Glendale, Arizona. Norma Christman Stukin, 94, Scottsdale, Arizona. Jeannie Foster, 74, Phoenix, Arizona. Midge Galst Gollner, 77, Phoenix, Arizona. William Redmond Gruel, 85, Phoenix, Arizona. Philip Haggerty, 94, Phoenix, Arizona. Nancy Kivett, 97, Tucson, Arizona. Carl Kunasek, 94, Phoenix, Arizona. John Peterson, 84, Pulteney, Vermont. Lynn or Carolyn Warder, 86, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Kent Worley, 63, Gilbert, Arizona. Those are the death notices from Sunday, July 26th. Next up, we go to today's business pages with Harvey Mackey's article titled, Sales Managers Are the Lifeblood of Sales. A sports enthusiast rented a dog at a hunting lodge and had wonderful luck with him. A month later, he went back and asked for the same dog. The lodge owner said, oh, you want seller, but we've raised his rate from $50 to $100. The hunter took the dog out anyway and enjoyed another fine day. When he came back a third time, he asked for seller again. The lodge owner explained that the dog was now called Super Seller and the cost was up to $150. The hunter took the dog out just the same, insisting he was well worth the money. The next month, when the hunter came back, he was greeted with a sad smile. The lodge owner said, you can't have your favorite dog this time. A few days ago, we made the mistake of naming him Sales Manager. Now all he does is sit on his tail and bark. One of the most important jobs of today's sales managers is to coach their salespeople. It's not enough to pep them up and motivate them. A sales manager needs to go out on sales calls and see what kind of research his or her sales reps have done to prepare for each call. They may need to be doing a lot more preparation. I always say there's no such thing as a cold call at the McKay Mitchell Envelope Company. When it comes to the qualities that make a good sales manager, there are several key attributes that stand out and are essential for success in this role. The first is leadership. A good sales manager leads by example. They inspire and motivate their team to achieve goals while maintaining high morale. Leadership involves setting a clear vision and guiding the team toward it. I like these words of wisdom from leadership guru John Maxwell. A leader is one who knows the way, goes the way, and shows the way. Second, effective communication is crucial. A sales manager must convey expectations clearly, provide constructive feedback, and foster open dialogue within the team. Third is empathy and emotional intelligence. Understanding team members' perspectives and emotions helps in building strong relationships. A sales manager with high emotional intelligence can manage conflicts and support their team effectively. Next, a good sales manager thinks strategically about market trends, customers' needs, and competitive positioning. They develop plans that align with the company's goals and adapt to changing circumstances. Sales managers should also be adept at coaching their team members, helping them develop their skills and reach their full potential. This involves providing guidance, support, and training. You don't rise to the occasion. You sink to the level of your training. Investing in training and development leads to the most significant return on investment a company can have, said Texas Judge J.P. George. Analytical skills are next on the list. Analyzing sales data to identify trends, measure performance, and make informed decisions is a critical part of the role. A good sales manager uses data to drive strategy and improve outcomes. The sales environment can be unpredictable. A successful sales manager remains resilient in the face of setbacks and adapts to new challenges with a positive attitude. Don't wish for things to be easier. Wish for you to be better. Last, but certainly not least, is integrity and trustworthiness. Building trust within the team and with clients is vital. A sales manager who acts with integrity earns respect and loyalty, which are crucial for long-term success. A great sales manager sells his staff on the importance of managing their sales skills. Repetition is the key to mastery. As you can tell, I love sales. I still have salesmen printed on my calling cards. There is no business until a salesperson brings it through the front door. Just think of the world without salespeople. That's why I was delighted when I found this gem from John Hancock Mutual Life, which I'm sure was written many years ago. The salesperson sells cars, tractors, radios, televisions, iceboxes, and movies, health and leisure, ambition and fulfillment. They ring a billion doorbells and enrich a billion lives. Without them, there'd be no American ships at sea, no busy factories, no 60 million jobs. For the great American salesperson is the great American civilizer, and everywhere they go, they leave people better off. And remember, here's Mac McKay's moral. A good sales manager is not just a boss. They're a leader, mentor, and strategist who empowers their team to achieve greatness. All right, that is Harvey McKay's article titled Sales Managers Are the Lifeblood of Sales. From there, we go to Ken Colburn's weekly feature on computers. His article today is titled, Why Leasing Apple Tech Might Not Be Worth It. Here's the question. I've heard Apple may offer a hardware leasing option for some of their products. What's your take? Here's the answer. According to recent reports, Apple is preparing to launch a subscription-style hardware leasing program called Apple Upgrade as soon as July 28th. The reported program, in partnership with Buy Now, Pay Later service Klarna, would allow customers to lease select iPhones, iPads, Macs, and Apple Watches for a monthly fee. It comes as global memory shortages have contributed to higher hardware prices, making smaller monthly payments potentially more attractive to consumers. While the convenience is undeniable, it represents another significant shift toward a world where we increasingly rent rather than own the technology we rely on every day. On the surface, leasing can be highly attractive. Instead of shelling out a large upfront sum for a new computer or a flagship phone, you swap that hit for a predictable monthly expense. The reported program would also allow early upgrades to newer models. But a lower monthly payment doesn't automatically mean a better deal. All right, here's the leasing versus buying aspect. The biggest difference comes down to ownership. When you buy a device outright or finance it through a traditional installment plan, you eventually own it once the payments stop. Under the reported Apple upgrade terms, iPhones and Apple Watches would carry 24-month commitments, while Macs and iPads would run for 36 months. At the end, you would likely return the device, pay to upgrade, or make a lump sum payment to keep it. This can make sense for tech enthusiasts who always want the latest features and have little interest in the hassle of selling old hardware. If, however, you tend to keep your devices for several years, ownership will likely offer better long-term value. All right, don't forget resale value. One number that's easy to overlook is what your device is worth when you're done with it. If you buy a $1,200 phone and trade it in for $400 a few years later, your net cost was $800. With a lease, you may hand the device back and walk away with nothing for the same or more money. When evaluating these offers, look beyond the monthly payment and calculate the total amount you'll pay over the entire term. All right, here's the perpetual payment trap. Early upgrades sounds like a great benefit, but they can also create a financial treadmill. If you buy a phone and keep it for 4 or 5 years, you'll eventually reach a point where the payments stop while the device keeps working. If you continually lease and upgrade, that monthly expense can become a permanent line item in your budget. Leasing also changes your relationship with the device. Code discovered in an iOS 27 beta reportedly indicates that Apple could restrict a leased or financed device to a handful of basic apps if payments become delinquent. Whether Apple ultimately implements this feature remains to be seen, but it illustrates an important distinction between owning and leasing connected technology. The reported lease also doesn't automatically include Apple Care Plus protection, so potential damage charges are another detail worth investigating. Leasing isn't inherently a bad deal, but don't judge one by the monthly payment alone. Look at the total cost, upgrade fees, damage policies, and what it will cost to eventually own the device. The most important number isn't what you pay each month, it's how much you've spent when it's time to give back a device you still don't own. All right, that's Ken Colburn's article titled, Why Leasing Apple Tech Might Not Be Worth It. Our next article is titled, Tariffs Likely Here to Stay. This is by David Lauder and Andrea Shalal. President Donald Trump had no time for lengthy tariff investigations when he returned to office last year, wanting to hammer trading partners right away to wring concessions. What followed was a chaotic start to a trade agenda that was eventually upended by a stinging Supreme Court defeat this year. Now he and his team are moving into a new phase to build a more durable U.S. tariff wall using more traditional and court-tested trade laws, those he had little patience for 18 months ago. His latest global tariff salvo, duties of 10% or 12.5% on 60 countries over allegedly weak enforcement of forced labor bans, marks the first of numerous tariff actions to be unveiled in the months ahead. They include probes into excess industrial capacity, alleged intellectual property theft, and national security protections for strategic industries, from semiconductors to robotics and industrial machinery. We're at the end of the beginning of the Trump tariff agenda, said Dan Yusko, an associate general counsel at Canadian oil producer Cenovus Energy, who specializes in U.S.-Canada trade. Within the next few weeks, and certainly by the end of the summer, we will see large parts of President Trump's trade policy fully in effect. This could bring more clarity and certainty for businesses on Trump's ultimate tariff structure, along with dread in foreign trade ministries, and they may have to cough up more concessions to protect access to a $3.4 trillion U.S. import market. All right, direct replacements. Trump's new anti-forced labor duties imposed under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, the unfair trade practices statute used against China during his first term, almost directly replace a global 10% temporary tariff that expired on July 24th. They cover 99.4% of U.S. imports, the U.S. Trade Representative's office said. This rebuilds part of Trump's signature Liberation Day tariffs of 10 to 50% on nearly every country, which the U.S. Supreme Court struck down as illegal under an untested national emergencies law Trump used to impose them. Another part of the baseline tariffs is likely to be rebuilt by another Section 301 investigation into excess industrial capacity, targeting 16 big trading partners, including China, the European Union, Japan, South Korea, Mexico, and Vietnam. That ongoing probe targets industrial subsidies and other export-focused policies. Amid a wider uproar over Trump's move, some viewed it as largely maintaining the status quo. Mark Bissell, CEO of Michigan-based vacuum maker Bissell Incorporated, said the newest tariffs were largely what the company anticipated, and it hadn't front-loaded inventory from China and elsewhere to try to beat them. We continued to run the business based on the belief that tariffs would stay in the 10 to 15% range, Bissell said in an email to Reuters. All right, here's the budget impact. Trump's gamble on quick but untested tariffs right out of the gate did four things. It heaped added costs onto retailers and other import-dependent industries. It brought dozens of trading partners to the negotiating table, yielding concessions for lower rates. It prompted swift retaliation and tariff escalation from China that led to a delicate truce, and it filled U.S. fiscal coffers with hundreds of billions of dollars. The Liberation Day tariffs alone yielded $166 billion in revenue, a major offset to a growing federal deficit, but refunds to importers have now turned those collections negative. The 150-day temporary tariffs, based on a law meant to quell balance of payment crises, have added $31 billion in assessed revenue through July 5th. But if a federal court ruling against them stands, that money, too, is subject to refund. With U.S. public debt approaching $40 trillion, Josh Lipsky, chair of international economics at the Atlantic Council, said subsequent administrations may become addicted to tariff revenue that is likely to be sustained. The tariff wall is being rebuilt strong brick by strong brick, and it's very durable, Lipsky said. Trump's broad use of Section 301 in the forced labor case prompted an immediate legal challenge by small businesses, but trade and legal experts say this will take time to play out. The statute has a solid track record in the courts, and judges may be reluctant to enjoin actions aimed at curbing forced labor and lowering barriers to U.S. goods. U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer made clear this past week that Trump will use everything at his disposal to erect tariffs to reshore production and shrink the trade deficit. The specific authorities this administration is using have changed, but the trade strategy has not, Greer told the U.S. Senate Finance Committee. All right, the timeline is unclear. Greer, who has not committed to a timeline for the industrial capacity investigations, has said the layers of tariffs being rebuilt will not exceed caps included in deals he has been negotiating, including 15% for the European Union, Japan, and South Korea, and higher rates for Southeast Asian countries. Administration officials say even though China is viewed as the world's largest source of excess manufacturing, its rates will not exceed the cap of about 20% agreed by Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping last November, which is on top of 25% tariffs from his first term. Some nominal or announced duties may be higher than actual applied rates, which analysts say may be an enforcement mechanism for countries to stick to agreed deal terms. Still, some things continue to come out of the blue, including the 50% duties on Canadian beer, dairy, hockey sticks, and other products Trump announced on July 20th over Ottawa's refusal to make trade concessions, and his threat to cut off all trade with Spain over not meeting NATO military spending targets. That proclivity for spontaneous tariff announcements remains an ongoing risk, said Eswar Prasad, a trade professor at Cornell University and former head of the International Monetary Fund's China Department. Trump's eagerness to impose tariffs to address a whole range of grievances will not only continue disrupting the global trading system, but will have significant adverse effects on American households and businesses. All right, that business article was titled Tariffs, Likely Here to Stay. And that was by David Lauder and Andrea Shalal. All right, from the business pages, we'll go to the sports pages, a little bit on the NBA. An article titled Marion and Paul Top 50 on All-Time Defender List. This is from Dwayne Rankin. Sean Marion isn't the only one wondering why he never earned NBA All-Defensive Team honors. Bleacher Report asked the same question about Marion in ranking the former Phoenix Suns forward 49th in its 99 NBA Best Defenders of All Time. The list posted July 25th. In hindsight, it looks kind of absurd that Sean Marion never made an All-Defensive Team, Bleacher Report wrote. He received Defensive Player of the Year votes in seven different campaigns. He was the most important perimeter defender on multiple championship contenders, including the title-winning 2011 Dallas Mavericks, and the wide range of his defensive contributions is nearly unprecedented. Marion was inducted into the Suns Ring of Honor on December 15, 2023. Marion finished his career with a 20.5 defensive rebounding percentage, a 2.3 steal percentage, and a 2.2 block percentage. Among players with at least 1,500 career minutes, Ben Wallace, Hakeem Olajuwon, Gar Hurd, and Andre Drummond are the only ones to match or exceed all three marks. Bleacher Report ranks Wallace fifth and Olajuwon fourth on the list. Other former Suns on the list are Chris Paul, 29th, Jason Kidd, 32nd, Tyson Chandler, 43rd, Dennis Johnson, 45th, Shaquille O'Neal, 71st, Paul Silas, 83rd, Larry Nance, 98th, and Don Busey, 99th. Paul is the only Suns player on the list to reach the NBA Finals while playing in Phoenix. One of the quickest and craftiest defenders of all time, 6 foot Paul, Chris Paul, made up for his lack of size and dominated that end of the floor with less conventional means, Bleacher Report wrote. He used foot speed to stay in front of bigger players and strength to stand up smaller ones. And when an opponent was remotely careless with the ball, CP3 was often able to take advantage. He averaged 2 steals for his career and led the league in that category in 6 of his first 9 seasons. All right, that article from today's sports pages was titled Marion Paul Top 50 on All-Time Defender List. Next up, we'll go to the sports in brief. Shin captures first win in 10 years at Scottish Open. Jenny Shin recorded her first win on the LPGA Tour in 10 years on Sunday by securing a two-stroke victory at the Women's Scottish Open in North Ayrshire. Shin entered the final round with a five-stroke lead and needed it. She overcame five bogeys to finish at three over par on Sunday at Dundonald Links and finished at nine under 279 for the tournament. The 33-year-old South Korean's last win on the tour was her maiden one in 2016 at the now defunct Volunteers of America Texas Shootout. "Yeah, my first win didn't really feel like a win at the time. I didn't feel like I deserved it," said Shin, who was still wet after being doused with water during the post-round celebration. "But this one definitely feels a lot different. This one feels like I earned it. I worked hard for it. I started working with my putting coach 4 years ago, and he asked me what my goal was. I said I needed to win before I retire. So I have been wanting it so badly in the last 4 years. I'm very, very excited." Next up, Royals Perez sets club mark with 318th home run. Salvador Perez, who hit the first home run of his career at Comerica Park in Detroit in 2011, set the Kansas City Royals all-time record with number 318 on Saturday at the same venue. In the Royals' 3-2 win over the Tigers, Perez tied the game at two in the seventh inning with a 401-foot solo shot to the left off right-handed reliever Kyle Finnegan. Perez's blast broke a tie with Hall of Famer George Brett, who hit 317 homers for Kansas City from 1973 to 1993. Like Brett, Perez has played his entire career with the Royals since debuting in 2011. "I think for everybody, he's the type of player everybody wants to be," Perez said of Brett. "Hall of Famer, everybody loves George in Kansas City. When you're around a name like him, it's pretty special." The celebration continued in the dugout, where Perez put on a broadcast headset and was surprised with a recorded tribute from Brett, who was in Cooperstown, New York, for Sunday's Hall of Fame induction ceremony. "You know, we played in different eras, but I think we got a lot in common," Brett said. "Playing for the name on the front of the jersey, wanting to be on the field no matter what, and most importantly, hating to lose. So today I'm as proud as ever to share a spot in Royals history with you." Next up, 49ers Shanahan to be limited in camp after serious car crash. 49ers head coach Kyle Shanahan broke his nose, three ribs, and his hand, needed over 40 stitches to his face, and sustained a severe concussion after he was involved in a car accident last week, San Francisco general manager John Lynch said on Saturday. Per police, the accident occurred on July 14th in Palo Alto when Shanahan collided with an SUV near his Northern California home. "He did break his nose and some black eyes are getting better," Lynch told reporters in a press conference. "He broke some ribs, that's painful, but that's not what's keeping him away. It's the concussion. And like I said, we'll continue to evaluate him, face him back, and as he can tolerate things, we'll expand those. And that will clearly be dictated by doctors and nothing else." The other driver was not injured, per Palo Alto Lieutenant Nicholas Martinez. Martinez added that drugs and alcohol were not involved. The 49ers said Shanahan will participate in team activities on a limited basis at the start of training camp, and doctors will not clear Shanahan for all activities until concussion symptoms clear. All right, that is today's sports in brief. All right, we're closing in on the midway point of today's reading of the Arizona Republic for Monday, July 27th. I want to remind you, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. And also, you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. All right, to get started, in our last half hour of today's reading of the Arizona Republic, we go to an article titled "Executing the Elderly Raises Concerns." And this is by Amanda Lee Myers and John Pacenti. At 80 years old, Florida death row inmate Dominic Ochicon has a heap of health issues. Heart trouble, poor kidney function, and a large prostate, arthritis, and degenerative disc disease, according to his attorneys. Ochicon has difficulties hearing, seeing, and walking, to the point that guards have to help him in and out of the shower and up and down stairs, according to court records filed by his lawyers. Still, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, signed a death warrant in June for Ochicon for the 1986 murder of his ex-fiancée's mother. The July 28th execution by lethal injection will make him the second oldest inmate ever executed in the nation and the oldest ever executed in Florida. Ochicon is among a growing number of elderly death row inmates who are facing their execution dates up to 5 decades after their crimes. The age and health of such inmates is raising an increasingly relevant question. How old is too old to be executed? Ochicon's attorneys argue in a recent Florida Supreme Court filing that executing such a sickly man is unconstitutional and amounts to manifest injustice, which shocks the conscience. It no longer serves any retributive value based on his advanced age and would serve only the purpose of vengeance, offending the dignity of our society, they argue. The states of Florida, which is executing more elderly inmates than any other state, disagrees. Ochicon has failed to demonstrate any national consensus against executing the elderly, the Florida Attorney General's office wrote in a recent filing, because executing Ochicon serves both a retributive and a deterrent effect, he has failed to demonstrate that his execution would result in a manifest injustice. Of the more than 1,900 death row inmates in the United States, at least 470, or about 25%, are older than 64, according to a USA Today analysis of State Corrections Department data and statistics from the nonprofit Death Penalty Information Center. By all accounts, the elderly death row population is growing as the appeals process and other delays add up to sometimes 5 decades. Many inmates have had their execution scheduled multiple times, only to have a last-minute appeal add years to their lives. In 2023, the average age of prisoners on death row was 54. That's compared with 39 years old in 2001, according to the Department of Justice Statistics and the Death Penalty Information Center. The oldest death row inmate in the United States were born in the 1930s. They include Blanche Taylor Moore, 93, convicted of fatally poisoning a boyfriend in 1986. Joseph Crazy Joe Naso, 92, convicted of killing at least 4 women in the 1970s and 80s. And David Carpenter, 96, known as the Trailside Killer, convicted of killing at least 7 people in the 1970s and 80s. Over the years, many death row inmates have died of natural causes before their executions are carried out. In November, Ralph Leroy Menzies, 67, died of presumed natural causes in Utah after spending 37 years on death row for the 1986 murder of Maureen Hunsaker, 26, a married mother of 3. His death came 2 months after the Utah Supreme Court stopped a firing squad from executing him over concerns that his dementia was so severe he wouldn't understand why he was being killed. After Menzies' death, Utah Attorney General Derrick Brown said that the state had pursued justice for decades. The path has been long and filled with pain, far more than any victim's family should ever have to endure. Florida is executing more elderly inmates than any other state by far. In 2025, and so far this year, six states have executed 23 inmates who are at least 62 years old, according to Death Penalty Information Center data analyzed by USA Today. 16 of them were in Florida. That's 70%. Florida made state history this year when Dusty Ray Spencer, 74, became the oldest prisoner put to death in the state on June 25th. He was executed for the death of his wife in front of her teenage son in 1992. That record was soon broken when Dennis Michael Sochor, convicted of killing an 18-year-old woman in 1981, was executed on July 14th. Sochor was 19 days older than Spencer had been. Florida is now planning to execute not only Ochicone on July 28th, but also former cop James Duckett, 68, for the 1987 kidnapping and murder of an 11-year-old girl. If both executions are carried out, it will be the first time in more than six decades that Florida will have put two inmates to death on the same day. DeSantis recently told ProPublica that meeting with the loved ones of victims reinforced his determination to see old death sentences carried out. There's a saying, justice delayed is justice denied, DeSantis said. We're doing it to be able to bring justice to the victims' families. Courts have found that certain inmates can't be executed based on factors related to age, as in Menzies' case in Utah. But there is no such thing in the United States as being too old to be executed if other factors like dementia aren't at play. The oldest inmate put to death in the United States was 83-year-old Walter Leroy Moody Jr., executed in 2018 in Alabama for the pipe bomb assassination of a federal judge. The Supreme Court currently recognizes three categorical exemptions from execution: those who are mentally incompetent, those who are intellectually disabled, and those who were younger than 18 when they committed murder. In 2017, then Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer expressed concerns about a 67-year-old inmate who had been on death row nearly half his life for the 1985 fatal shooting of an Alabama police officer. The inmate, Vernon Madison, had suffered strokes, vascular dementia, was legally blind, couldn't walk on his own, and was incontinent, Breyer pointed out. His disability leaves him without a memory of his commission of a capital offense, Breyer said at the time. Given this trend, we may face ever more instances of state efforts to execute prisoners suffering the diseases and infirmities of old age, Breyer continued. And we may well have to consider the ways in which lengthy periods of imprisonment between death sentence and execution can deepen the cruelty of the death penalty while at the same time undermining its penological rationale. All right, that article was titled Executing the Elderly Raises Concerns, and that was by Amanda Lee Myers and John Pacenti. Our next article is titled Biotech Experts Call for FDA Changes. They want assurances that drug reviews are based on science, not politics. This is by Dina Beasley. Biotech experts and industry executives are calling plans by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, hit by job cuts last year, to hire thousands of employees and update clinical trial standards encouraging, but want assurance that politics will not interfere in the agency's drug review process. Regulatory predictability is ultimately what keeps promising science from being abandoned before it reaches patients, said John Guy, policy director at the Incubate Coalition, a venture capital advocacy group. The agency's current priority should be rebuilding durable scientific expertise. Under Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the FDA has lost more than 3,000 employees, including key division heads, through cuts and departures. John Crowley, CEO of the BIO, or Bio Industry Trade Group, described the cuts as the DOGE wrecking ball, referring to the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency, which was initially spearheaded by Elon Musk. Crowley added that the FDA needs to do more to standardize review processes. Longtime FDA Cancer Division head Richard Pazdur and other former agency officials in recent months have called the regulator too political, with key decisions on drugs and vaccines being made by then-Commissioner Marty McCarry or his department heads. McCarry resigned in May amid mounting criticism, and Biologics Division Chief Vinay Prasad departed in April amid controversy over vaccine trial revisions and rare disease drug rejections. The FDA's main drug review arm has had six different leaders since January 2025, when President Donald Trump began his second term, and is also now led by a temporary director. Since early June, the FDA has announced plans to fill 2,200 open positions, shorten clinical trial timelines, and speed development of cell and gene therapies. Some policy changes are being driven by global competition, including from China, which has now outstripped the United States in clinical trial volume. The one thing the FDA is very focused on is cell therapy, said Paul Hastings, CEO of biotech company Nkarta, based in South San Francisco, California. We are in the lead and want to keep that lead. The FDA long viewed as the global gold standard for assessing drug safety and effectiveness, so far has been able to maintain its pace of drug approvals, but investors are watching closely, Guy said. The administration appears to be focused on three candidates for Trump to nominate as FDA commissioner and is awaiting his final decision, according to two sources familiar with the process, speaking on condition of anonymity. They are White House domestic policy aide Heidi Overton, oncologist Jeffrey Vasirka, and Pentagon health official Stephen Ferrara. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment. All right, calls for less interference. The exits of McCarry and Prasad are an opportunity to consider FDA leadership needs and where the boundary lies between political power and scientific judgment, former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb wrote in a June editorial in the medical journal JAMA. Gottlieb called for reinstating the overarching standard that FDA Medical Products Centers be led by experienced scientific and clinical experts. Emily Hilliard, a Department of Health and Human Services spokesperson, said in an email that suggesting that the agency's regulatory actions reflect politics rather than science misrepresents the FDA's review process and the hard work of its dedicated career scientists, physicians, and other experts. Decisions by the Trump administration's political appointees at the FDA include Prasad's refusal to review Moderna's mRNA flu vaccine. Kennedy, long known for anti-vaccine views, has criticized mRNA vaccines cutting their U.S. government research funding. Prasad later reversed course and accepted the application after Moderna, according to media reports, took the issue directly to the White House. Other incidents like McCarry's public criticism of an application for a Huntington's disease treatment believed to be a gene therapy from Netherlands headquartered UniCure but it's a Q-U-R-E, fueled the idea that drug makers and patients were being treated unfairly. We can get better by innovating, not just in technology, but in how we evaluate, how we standardize criteria for FDA review, said Paul Watton of RBL Ventures, a Houston-based biotech venture creation studio. Upheaval at the agency has not affected cell therapy developer Kyverna in Emeryville, California, said CEO Warren Biddle, although it did call into question a pathway forward for some of these therapies. Elizabeth Youngman, a global regulatory attorney at law firm Hogan Lovells Cadwalader and former chief of staff to the FDA commissioner, said the traditional barrier between FDA leadership and drug reviews was perforated, and it remains to be seen whether the role of FDA scientific staff will be fully restored. It's entirely possible that we are in the eye of the storm right now, Youngman said. All right, that article from today's paper was titled Biotech Experts Call for FDA Changes. Next, we'll go to Today in History. Today is July 27th. On this date in 1890, Dutch post-impressionist artist and painter Vincent van Gogh shot himself in the chest in the wheat fields of Auvers-sur-Oise outside of Paris. He died 2 days later. 1921, surgeon Frederick Banting and medical student Charles Best successfully isolated the sugar-regulating hormone insulin in a lab at the University of Toronto. The discovery revolutionized diabetes treatment, saving countless lives. Banting and MacLeod were both awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for their work. All right, on this day in 1974, the first article of impeachment for obstruction of justice against President Richard Nixon was passed by the House Judiciary Committee on a vote of 27 to 11. Two more articles were passed a few days later. Nixon resigned in early August 1974. In 1995, the Korean War Veterans Memorial, located on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., was dedicated. That was put together by the USA Today Network. Now we'll do a few celebrity birthdays here. We have comedian writer Carol Leifer turned 70, actor, martial artist Donnie Yen, 63, singer Julian Hatfield, 59, writer-producer Brian Fuller, 57, actor Nicolaj Coster-Waldau, 56, actor-comedian Maya Rudolph, 54, author Cassandra Clare, 53, drummer Abe Cunningham from the Deftones, 53, singer Pete Yorn, 52, actor Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, 49, comedian Heidi Gardner, 43, actor Taylor Schilling, 42, actor Olivia Alin Lind, 19. All right, that's today's celebrity birthdays. Next up, we will go to today's horoscopes. And again, today, Monday, July 20th. 7th. For today's horoscopes, we will start with Aries, which goes from March 21st to April 19th. Confidence grows through authentic self-expression. Are you willing to embrace change while staying true to yourself? Live from your heart. Taurus, April 20th, May 20th. Do you trust your inner compass? The sun makes a unique alignment with Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto today. Listen closely. Gemini, May 21st, June 21st. You have a message to get across. Mustering the courage to stand up and communicate something that may be controversial. Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd. Reshaping your priorities. The sun makes a unique pattern. Strip away what's lost value. Leo, July 23rd, August 22nd. It's your time to shine. Lead with authenticity. Virgo, August 23rd, September 22nd. Something profound is unfolding behind the scenes in your life. Next up is Libra, September 23rd, October 23rd. The future's so bright, you've got to wear shades. Feeling the enthusiasm to bring your big dreams into reality? Next up, we have Scorpio, October 24th, November 21st. Profound internal shifts act as catalysts for bold moves in the outer world. Sagittarius, November 22nd, December 21st. Mental and relational shifts open doors for you now. Embrace new perspectives and unexpected opportunities that expand your horizon. Capricorn, December 22nd, January 19th. Prepare for a light bulb moment. Personal growth unfolds. Aquarius, January 20th, February 18th. Relationships are catalysts for growth today. Are you understanding what you need to change to renew your happiness? And finally, from today's horoscopes, we have Pisces, February 19th to March 20th. Feeling empowered to improve your daily reality, a spotlight shines on making practical choices that will have lasting impact. All right, from today's horoscopes, we go to Dear Abby. This one is titled, Jeanne or Jeannie Phillips bids adieu as Dear Abby continues. Dear readers, as anyone who reads Dear Abby knows, I have always stressed the importance of writing thank you notes. It is now time for me to put pen to paper. I have always considered you, my readers, to be my friends. Thank you for accepting me as warmly as you always have, and thank you for being willing to share your joys, pains, and frustrations with me these many years. Your trust is the greatest honor I have ever been given. I am now in my 39th year of penning the Dear Abby column, which started on January 9th, 1956, written by my late mother, Pauline Phillips. When I began writing it in 1987, I promised myself that when the time came to retire, I would step aside to live life without a deadline. I am grateful for the support of my two loyal and able assistants, Stephen Andrews and Jose Fuentes. Please don't worry about me. My health is fine. In the years ahead, my column will continue to serve you. It will be written by a capable editorial staff. Please wish me a happy retirement as I open this new chapter of my life. I love you all. This is from Jeanne or Jeanne, Jeannie Phillips, AKA Dear Abby. All right, here's another one. Dear Abby, my husband's brother, Hank, has estranged himself from the family. He's married with two children, but has little to no contact with his mom, dad, stepdad, sister, brother, my husband, or any of his nieces and nephews, except when he calls his parents asking for money. On the rare occasions I have seen him, his wife refuses to participate in any family gatherings, dinners, or even photos. There's always a string of excuses or obvious lies, and none of us can understand why they have chosen to stay so distant. Since becoming part of this family, I have watched Hank manipulate situations to get what he wants. He is extremely persuasive and plays the victim well. He is caught in a cycle of being unable to keep a job while trying to maintain a lifestyle far beyond his means. I do have some sympathy because it's clear there are deeper issues behind his behavior, but the pattern of drifting in and out of our lives, especially my in-laws, has become exhausting. They finally reached the point where they're no longer willing to give him money, but I worry about the future. As my in-laws continue to age and potentially become more vulnerable, I fear Hank will find new ways to take advantage of them. I love them, and it has been painful watching them be used and hurt for so many years. And this is from Conflicted in Missouri. Dear Conflicted, manipulating older folks to get them to fork over money is called elder abuse, and there are laws against it. Although it may be a bit premature, it couldn't hurt for you and your husband to consult an attorney who specializes in elder law and discuss your concerns, because crimes like this happen too often. All right, that is today's Dear Abby. And that was titled Jeannie Phillips Bids Adieu as Dear Abby Continues. All right, next up, we will have time for maybe a couple of comics here. We'll get to Beetle Bailey. We'll start off with Beetle Bailey. And again, we got Sarge Irate, and Beetle, of course, is relaxing and leaning against a tree, it looks like. And there's a shovel over there. You can see where Beetle's obviously supposed to be digging a foxhole or some type of hole anyway. And Sarge comes over and says, "I knew I'd catch you napping." And then Beetle responds, "I did everything you ordered me to do, so what's wrong?" And Sarge turns around and walks away with a really grumpy look on his face and says, "I'm sure I'll think of something." All right, that's Beetle Bailey by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. Next up, we go to Today's Pickles by Brian Crane. And we got, looks like Earl walking down the street, and his wife and her friend are kind of a bit ahead of them. And she turns around and yells, "Earl, are you coming?" And she talks to her friend and says, "My husband's a Neanderthal." "Don't you mean Neanderthal?" "No, he's a Neanderthal. Someone who walks slowly and aimlessly." All right, that's Today's Pickles by Brian Crane. Next up, we'll go to Baby Blues by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott. And we have the husband and wife, looks like they're sitting on the a porch swing perhaps, and they're talking, and the wife says to her husband, "Remember when we were newlyweds and we'd stay up late and talk for 4 or 5 hours?" And then he turns to her and says, "We still do that." And then he continues, and then you can see the kids hopping around now with them. "It's just that those 4 or 5 hours are spread out over a year." All right, that's the Baby Blues by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott. All right, that's going to bring us to the close. Today's reading of the Arizona Republic for Monday, July 27th. Thanks for joining us. And I'm volunteer reader Philip Varellan. Remember to stay tuned for further great programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.